This is a lecture given at St. David's Episcopal Church in Austin, Texas. Visit our website, stdave.org.
Thank you, Mona. And thank you all. A very quick about me. My name is Will Scheel. I've been at Plant With Purpose since February. Prior to joining the team, I was the World Missions Director at St. Martin's Episcopal Church in Houston, and was instrumental in bringing on Plant With Purpose as one of our mission partners. And as we got to know their work better, we became such a fan of their mission. I personally became such a fan of their mission that when the chance to join Plant With Purpose's team came up, I kind of jumped at it. And so that is, oh my goodness, sorry. I'm still getting used to Mona's computer. And really the mission is where we need to start. And that is to reverse poverty and deforestation around the world by transforming the lives of the rural poor. I don't know why this is not advancing. There we go. And this mission is really driven by six core values of ours. They are faith. We always want to honor Christ. They are empowerment. We want to build capacity and strength within our communities, within our partners, to empower them to transform their own lives. We also want to work in a collaborative environment. We want to work together. We want to be co-creators, not just teacher and student. Fourth, building on that collaboration, we want our work to be innovative. We always want to be learning and improving and trying to maximize our potential, which leads us into stewardship. We want to obviously optimize our resources and the resources of our partnering farmers to achieve the most good. And then lastly, we want our work to be sustainable. You know, I always say that I want us to work ourselves out of a job. That is what I think everyone in mission is ultimately trying to do. We want to foster long-term health. Also driving our work is the question, why and how should Christians care about the environment? And so for us at Plant With Purpose, a few of the most compelling reasons are one, that the Bible tells us that the environment belongs to God. And you can read Psalm 24 up there, hopefully. It says, the earth is the Lord's and everything in it, the world and all who live in it. And really the ability of our planet to support and sustain life reflects Christ's vision for an abundant life, as we see in John 10:10, which says, I have come that they may have life and have it to the full. And while the environment belongs to God, we have also received a mandate to care for creation. Our first calling as humans, as early as we see in Genesis, is to be caretakers of creation. And then throughout scripture, we see lessons of stewardship in Proverbs and specifically in Jesus's parables, which means that we have a responsibility to one another to be thoughtful about how our actions impact one another. But beyond just saying that there is a biblical mandate, we also find connection to God and nature, such that the environment provides us an opportunity to stir our hearts to worship. The Psalms, again, throughout scripture, we see examples of writers being moved to worship at the wonder of creation. And Christ himself encourages to learn from creation, pausing to consider nature, the wildflowers, the sparrow, and other elements of his natural design. So I want you to pause for just a second here real quick and close your eyes and think about a time where you've been in nature and felt intimately connected to God. For me, my God place is Big Bend National Park, specifically the Chisos Basin, watching the sunset through the window. And what's so powerful about that moment, at least for me, is not only that in that moment I'm drawing closer to God, but also that the memory evokes such a strong sense of closeness. So it's the power of nature to stir our hearts in that moment and beyond. I kind of love this quote from George Washington Carver that captures that sentiment so well. It says, to me, nature is the little windows through which God permits me to commune with him, to see much of his glory by simply lifting the curtain and looking in. I love to think of nature as wireless telegraph stations throughout which God speaks to us every day, every hour, and every moment of our lives. It is this connectedness that inspires each of us to not only give thanks, but to be moved to action. Another quote that kind of captures this idea comes from Noé, our country director in Burundi, who says, working and protecting the environment is a way to serve God at the same level as preaching and singing. And through caring for the environment as an act of worship, we can ultimately fulfill the second great commandment, which is loving our neighbors. Micah 6:8 says, what does the Lord require of us? It says to act justly, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with your God. Thus, caring for the environment is a justice issue that allows us to live out that mandate from Micah 6:8. And if you want to help the global, and if you want to help in global poverty, you have to include environment, you have to address the environment. They are inextricably linked. And we as Christians, I think, can offer a very unique and significant opportunity to present, to participate in that renewal. And especially given that the world right now is so focused on climate issues. A good example of that is the United Nations. They just announced back this summer that they have started, the next decade is the decade of ecosystem restoration, which, you know, directly supports our work. And if you look at the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals, you can see that our work addresses each one of these areas that they are focused on. Because the harsh truth is that climate change is simply not fair. The evangelical scientist Catherine Hayhoe says the poorest and most vulnerable among us, those who have done the least to contribute to the problem, are the most affected. Studies seem to believe that climate change threatens to cut crop yields for our global poor who are already on the brink by an additional 25%, which makes living in poverty and rural poverty just completely unsustainable. Now, when we talk about the global poor, it's important to kind of note that 85% of the world's poorest people live in rural areas, and they rely largely on agriculture for their livelihood. That equates to about 1 billion people on the planet. And agricultural development is one of the most powerful tools to end extreme poverty and boost shared prosperity. Now, globally, we've been making some really incredible strides in reducing the percentage of people that are living in extreme poverty. In the last two decades, since 1999, the number of people has fallen by more than 1 billion that are living in extreme poverty as a result of some of these measures that have been taken. But part of the success in reducing poverty is set to be reversed because of the COVID-19 pandemic. And for the first time in 20 years, poverty is likely to significantly increase in the coming years. This is why our intervention is so important right now. Now, I want to take a second, because we are talking about poverty. I want to acknowledge that poverty is incredibly complex. It's multidimensional and includes many, many variables. If you're living off the land, the health of the ecosystem is critical. And simply increasing your finances is, without considering any of the environmental impacts, is simply going to threaten long-term sustainability. At Plant with Purpose, we measure poverty using a multidimensional poverty index. As you can see, if you look around the wheel, there are 12 factors across six main categories. And if you look, only one of which is truly financial in nature. A good example of ways in which poverty can not show up in the amount of savings someone has is by looking under the food category under nutrition and asking the question, does the family have a balanced diet? Another one that I think is often hidden is the matter of time and opportunity, and specifically for school-age children and school-age girls. So one of the questions we want to ask when we are working with our participants is, if a family has a secondary school age daughter, is she going to school? Because these are categories which are all critical to holistic transformation and risk being lost if we just focus on financial health and stability. So how do we break the cycle of poverty for the rural farmer whose livelihood depends on the land? At Plant with Purpose, our solution is the watershed approach. When we talk about a watershed, we're talking about a region defined by rivers and streams that all flow into a common larger body of water. I'll go into that a little bit more in a second. And the idea is that there is a literal trickle-down effect throughout the region from neighbor to neighbor. And by once we reach about 50% of the families within a watershed, the entire region experiences reductions in poverty, the ecosystem is restored, and deforestation is reversed, which all of which kind of benefits the community long-term. Once we identify a watershed that we want to work in, we obviously then want to look at the communities that we're trying to work with. And the way we select communities is based on a bunch of different factors. We look at levels of poverty, difficulty of terrain, how degraded the environment is, how deforested it is, as well as the vulnerability of the people. And if there's mutual interest, we don't want to go into a watershed, into a community, if they're not yet ready to work with us. So once we've identified a watershed, and then we've identified communities within that watershed that we want to work, then we create purpose groups. And purpose groups are roughly 25 to 30 individuals that come together and are community-based and locally led. And they are the foundation of our watershed model and approach, which brings neighbors together to learn, to collaborate, and encourage one another across these four main areas that you can hopefully read. We have three modalities, three key pillars of our work. The first is environmental restoration, and that can kind of be broken out into two main categories. The first of which is farmer field schools, where we're teaching members of the purpose group about soil health and how to increase crop yields. We also talk about reforestation and the essentialness of trees and how they play into increasing crop yields. And then when it gets to the second pillar that we talk about is economic empowerment. And that is where we have savings groups. We teach them how to form savings and loan groups, which help them increase their resilience and self-reliance. And then finally, the piece that underpins it all for me is spiritual renewal. We have discipleship curriculums and partner with local churches, empowering them to be leaders, teaching ideas around value, inherent value, natural gifts that we all have, all of which I'm going to go into a little bit more here now. But first, I want to start by talking about the watershed. This is just a visual representation. So you can think of it like geographic regions. Think about like, a valley. I went to Kauai in Hawaii a couple of years ago, and there are these big, huge valleys, right? And on the peaks, water all flows down. And so all the streams, all the rainwater, all the groundwater, everything that is within those two geographic boundaries flows out towards the ocean. And that's kind of what this is represented here. And I went and I looked, this is your watershed. So this is the Austin watershed map. You can see it goes all the way down to Dripping Springs and Buda. And if you look on the smaller image of Texas to the left, you can see that giant blue section. That is actually the entire Colorado River water basin watershed. It starts way up in Dawson County. It's 862 miles long, and it kind of meanders between Brownwood and San Angelo and Brady before cutting through Austin on its way out to Matagorda Bay. Thank you for indulging me. I went looking and this was fun. All right, so once we've identified watersheds and communities, we then group participants into purpose groups. And as I said before, these are community-based and locally empowered. And in those purpose groups, they're going to learn across, again, those three main modalities, which are farmer field schools, which includes reforestation, savings groups, and spiritual communities. In farmer field schools, we teach a bunch of different modules. They're all included in our Seeds of Change curriculum, which we share across all eight countries. And these are the six main modules that we teach: working at a watershed, soil conservation, agroforestry, biointensive agriculture, and the list goes on. Y'all can hopefully read that. But the point I kind of want to stop and make sure y'all are aware of is that we're not just going in and telling people, this is the one way to do it, because we work in eight different countries, soon to be nine, across a bunch of different contexts, across a bunch of different ecosystems. And so what may work in southern Mexico will not work in the mountainous regions of Haiti. And so it's incredibly important for our farmers to be able to test and co-develop the regenerative agriculture techniques that work for them. Ultimately, they take what they learn and apply it to their own land. This is a farmer's plot. And this is a very typical example of a partnering farmer's land after several years of work in our program. As you can see, it's not flat like we would have in the United States. It's not monoculture. Instead, what you're seeing is it's hilly. You can see lush soil. You can see multiple crops being planted amongst one another. And what used to be rocky and barren now is bearing fruit. Ultimately, our partnering farmers apply about 89% more diverse regenerative agriculture techniques as a result of our work, which results in about 37% higher crop yields. This kind of increase in yields wouldn't be possible, though, without tree planting. Why trees? Well, because they have such a positive impact on the environment and on economic outcomes for our partnering farmers. They contribute to all of these things. And specifically, they provide clean water. They help increase soil health. They stabilize weather activity. They create opportunities for economic empowerment. And I want to go back to the slide of the farm for a second, because I wanted to make sure y'all saw what was there in addition to the crops. It was the trees. And you see them not only surrounding the crops, but mixed in between. This provides natural weather barriers. They anchor and enrich the soil. They prevent erosion. They provide natural tree cover, natural protection, and their sources of income. Trees literally do everything, and it's why they're so integral to our approach. In addition to the benefit that they have for the farmers on a very individual level, they also have enormous environmental impacts. Participants plant 4.3 times as many trees as non-participants, and this creates a measurable change in vegetation. Literally, reforestation can be seen and measured. So NDVI means Normalized Difference Vegetation Index, and this is a satellite image from Sabana Real. It's a community near the Haitian and Dominican border. And as you can see, we took pictures taken around the same time of year between 2003 and 2019. So as you can see from these three photos, the impact is not just at a community level. It is having a widespread impact that we can see from literally space. And they really reflect what's possible when our partnering farmers come to understand how important trees are to improving their lives and the land. A great example of this is Samuel. So this is Samuel's land in 2016, and that is Samuel's land in 2020. He joined our work as part of our pilot project in Kukumba in the Democratic Republic of Congo in 2015. And he said, "I lived a miserable life with my family for many years, and the food from my farms was just for consumption with no reserves to improve my income. After being trained on the environmental core curriculum and how to restore the environment, I decided to use one farm to plant trees who can later generate income. Now he's at the point where he can actually, he's created seedlings, and he's taking seedlings and selling those to other community members so that they can too also plant trees to improve their situation. As farmers like Samuel improve their land and start generating income, it's important for them to be able to make that income work for them in multiple ways, which brings us to our savings groups. The key aspects of our savings group are this. Members save money by depositing small amounts every week, which the base amount is set by the group. They can actually save more if they want to. Second, members can have access to loans, again, from within the group. I want to make sure y'all know that we don't put any money into these savings groups. Every penny and dollar that is generated in wealth in these savings groups is generated as a result of the savings of our partnering farmers. All we give them is the box. And again, we kind of give them a set of bylaws, which they can manipulate into how they see fit most important for their environment or for their community. And then also they elect their own leaders, and they're the ones that set the reasonable interest rate. And that varies widely across countries, from country to country. And then the last thing I want to kind of touch on, well, first, let me say this. As a result of joining our savings groups and participating in our savings groups, participants have about 2.5 months of savings on average, whereas non-participating farmers earn and typically have less than 1 month's savings. And a special thing about our groups that I think is just wonderful is that our groups also collect a social fund at every meeting. In addition to putting in their personal share that they're going to get a return on savings for, they collect money for a social fund to help assist with community needs as they see fit. When they see a need, they come together, they make a decision collectively as a group. And there's a story that I remember that I think really illustrates it well, which is that members of a community, I'm blanking on which country it was in, but members of a community saw a community member who was not a participant in that savings group, who was living in incredibly dire conditions. They decided to take their money and pool it together and build her a house. And she went from having the worst home in the community to having the best home in the community, all as a result of this community savings group. And that's a picture that you can see of, you know, typically it's sometimes they gather in buildings like this, not buildings like St. David's, but they gather in structures. Sometimes they're gathering outside people's homes. Another important aspect of our savings and loans groups is that it empowers members to have access to loans at reasonable interest rates, like we talked about earlier. But look at the main types of loans that people are taking out. The largest one is crops. Typically, it's to plant additional or different multi-dimensional types of crops, multiple variations. They also will use them to take out loans for animals so they can diversify their income by owning livestock. Oftentimes they'll use it to pay for education for their children. And then lastly, they'll often also use it to start a new business that they can think of. All of this creates the opportunity to diversify their income in a way which translates to increased resiliency over time. You know, being less reliant on a single source of income and being able to have multiple incomes to rely upon when one is particularly disrupted. So this brings us to the third pillar of our work, which is spiritual renewal. I'm going to pause here for a minute and talk about how we engage with our partners about within the context of spiritual renewal. And I want to talk a few minutes about why. For us at Plant with Purpose, it really boils down to a belief that everything has a spiritual component, whether we want to acknowledge it or not. I think often we in the West have become so used to a dualistic worldview that it has allowed us to separate the physical from the spiritual and to imagine that the economic and agricultural aspects of our work are really spiritually neutral. And that's not the case in most of the communities where we work, nor does it reflect a biblical worldview. We've also learned that promoting spiritual renewal makes sense from a purely practical standpoint. Simply stated, our program interventions work better when the attitudes of community members have been transformed by a new understanding of their identity in Christ. Many years ago, our director in the Dominican Republic confided in a pattern that he'd noticed as a result of our work. The farmers in our program, as they became wealthier, first they would buy a TV, then they would buy rum, and ultimately they would start a second family on the side. And this is emphatically not the kind of development that we were shooting for, which led us to the question, the whole nature of poverty. Some of y'all probably are aware, as Jacomer Christian observed, and has since been expanded on by many, many, many wonderful authors, poverty is not really about the lack of material possession. At its core, poverty is about relationships that are broken. That includes relationships between God and human beings, between human beings and neighbors, between humans and nature, and also even in our own relationships with ourselves. So the transformation of attitudes as a result of our spiritual renewal efforts has led us to some of the most significant changes that we've seen in our work. And it reinforces the effectiveness of the other aspects of our program. Savings group members who believe that they've been created in God's image and have been given unique talents are eager to invest and to grow. Churches whose leaders believe they're working for a larger purpose have become leaders of reconciliation efforts in the Eastern Congo, making everything else we do more effective. Farmers who understand God's love for creation have become leaders on local reforestation efforts. And Neighbors Loving Neighbors have made the savings group local centers for development and community care. Now, we couple savings groups with agricultural and environmental training because it's demonstrated to be significantly more effective than either just savings groups or economic agricultural training on its own. But really, spiritual renewal, with its impact on participant attitudes and motivations, is the special sauce when you add it to the mix. And it results in a far more powerful and virtuous cycle. Ultimately, what we share with our communities, specifically what the curriculum we share, is very contextual. In most of the regions where we work, the church is already present. We believe we are not called to replace it, and instead our work is best done in collaboration with and support of the existing church communities. However, in the interest of reconciling factions and promoting unity within the church, we also do not align with any particular denomination or any individual church body, nor do we try and teach anything that might replace or contradict the core doctrines or beliefs of any church or denomination. Rather, the topics and curriculum that we teach are intended to strengthen the local church, aid it in its outreach, provide common ground for church factions who maybe are in conflict. Where we have a particular expertise, we also provide supplementary teachings. Some of them include the kingdom of God. Themes that we talk about include the kingdom of God, the church's role in community, the theology of work, creation care, and reconciliation. It's within these supplementary themes we're often trying to convey simpler ideas that are easily accessible regardless of the context. So for example, in our theology of work curriculum, we want our farmers to know a few things. One, that work is a gift from God. Two, every one of us are given talents that can be used to further God's kingdom here on earth. And three, one of the ways we're made in God's image is that like God, we are inherently creative. And we have seen few things as transformative as individuals who discover they have something to contribute to God's kingdom here on earth. And while we try to reflect all of this in our own witness as staff, as country staff, as US-based staff, we believe that the local church has to be the primary vehicle for evangelism. This is why we are not an evangelizing organization, but we do support local churches in that effort. Furthermore, we never want to give an impression that conversion is a prerequisite for participation. Instead, we want to lovingly and joyfully serve partners of all faiths and no faith without prejudice or pressure. So as a result, when we evaluate our work within the realm of spiritual renewal, and we ask about the impact of our work, community members, participants agree 96% with the statement that our community works together to solve problems. And 70% agree with the statement that my work is a good use of my talents. And 95% agree with the statement that I now feel pride in the work that I do. All right, so now I've kind of given you a detailed explanation of all three of our pillars: economic empowerment, environmental restoration, and spiritual renewal. I kind of want to pull that all together by sharing a case study that we did from the Democratic Republic of Congo. So in 2015, Plant with Purpose launched our work in the Democratic Republic of Congo. And we did it using, for the very first time, our watershed methodology. Prior to that, we weren't specifically intentionally going in and identifying watersheds and communities within watersheds. So this was a real opportunity for us to find out just how effective our watershed approach was. And so in 2015, we started our two-year pilot. We went out, we identified two watersheds that we wanted to compare. One we would work in, one would be our control comparison. The participant watershed, it was the Kakumba watershed. And we ran a baseline study across both of those watersheds. And then we went to work in the Kakumba watershed. And then 2 years later, we came back and did a second study, a follow-up study. What we found was that direct participants in the Kakumba watershed where we worked cut their poverty index scores by 68%, in just 2 years. And indirect participants, people who did not even participate in our program, cut poverty levels by 44%, which means every single person across the Kakumba watershed saw a poverty reduction rate of about 60%, regardless of participation. And that was, again, being measured across our multidimensional poverty index factors that you can see there. And at the bottom, you can see, or I don't know if you can read it or not, but participant families in the DR Congo are sufficient in an average of 8 out of 12 of our key indicators as compared to non-participant families that average a proficiency in only 4. At the end line, so at the end, Kakumba families had over 30 times the saving of families in the comparison watershed. Kakumba families help their neighbors twice as often as comparison families, and they're twice as likely to agree that their faith sustains them in challenging circumstances. And lastly, do y'all remember where we talked about the multidimensional poverty index and specifically about young women being pulled out of school at first? Kakumba families sent secondary school age girls to school 2.6 times more frequently at inline compared to a 27% decline in the comparison area. This is why we do what we do, right? And so I want to close today by sharing where we work. We started our work in the Dominican in 1984, largely in response to hurricanes. We continue to work in 2 watersheds in the Dominican. One is on the Haitian-Dominican border, and then another one is kind of at the top of the Ozama watershed, which feeds directly into Santo Domingo. And we work there specifically in rural community contexts. And there is, I have to brag, the Dominican just, we finished our program year in June of this year. We run July to June, and the Dominican team and partnering farmers planted over 1.7 million trees last year, which is just super exciting for us. Mexico, we work in 3 of Mexico's states with the highest poverty rates, Chiapas, Oaxaca, and Puebla. One of the key factors that we focus on in Mexico, specifically in Oaxaca, is working with migrant indigenous populations. We are trying to hope that our work can curb the pressure of migration. In Oaxaca, there is the Zapotecan indigenous community. They have, I think it's an 85% migration rate for men in that community because there is no opportunity for them to stay and work. That is why we're working with indigenous communities in Mexico. Haiti in 1997, obviously Haiti has been in the news recently. It continues to be in the news. It is one of the most heavily deforested countries in the world. And often one of the driving factors of poverty and deforestation is tree cutting for coal, because it's often the fastest way to create some income. And so we work with our Haitian farmers to help prevent lasting damage specifically to create resilience to natural disasters, both like the earthquake and also the tropical storm that recently hit. And so that is our Latin American and Caribbean set of places where we work. We then started working in Africa in 2002. We work along the foot of Mount Kilimanjaro, and our focus there is on women's integration. And the annual tree planting competition there is also a huge, huge deal. I want to say they planted over 1.5 million trees last year and are constantly trying to push the limit of what is possible with regards to tree planting. And then we also work in Thailand. We established our work there in 2004. A lot of what we do in Thailand is rooted in human rights and has a human rights component to our work. And specifically, we're working with ethnic minorities. This is kind of a theme that you'll see often is we're working with the most vulnerable, and that also often happens to be indigenous populations. And then we started working in Burundi in 2008. As you can see here, Burundi is is frequently ranked as one of the most food insecure countries in the world. And 90% of Burundi relies on agriculture for income and survival. And then the Democratic Republic of Congo, we talked a little bit about Kakumba. We're growing our work there exponentially right now. We're about to expand it to 5 new watersheds in the Democratic Republic of Congo. And it is one of the top five most climate vulnerable countries in the world. I think that's something worth mentioning. And then Ethiopia. Obviously, Ethiopia has also been in the news. We work with Ethiopian Orthodox churches there and their focus on church forests. And I'm going to tell you now, if you have never Googled National Geographic Ethiopia church forest, do it. There's an article that is that was written a couple years ago. The photography is beautiful, and it just paints a beautiful picture of just how much the Ethiopian Orthodox Church has incorporated nature, and specifically trees, into their spiritual practice. And it's just really, really beautiful. So if you haven't done that, highly, highly encourage, go Google church forests in Ethiopia. So what does that mean? Where are we now? Progress to date. So right now we're working with 307,460 direct participants. I want to say the last time Valerie was here over or right at 4 years ago, we were working with about 193,000. By 2025, we want to be working with double this number. Additionally, we've planted 43,376,455 trees. Again, when Valerie was here in 2017, that number was 23 million, or just over 23 million. And in the next 4 years, by 2025, we want to plant another 40 million. So it took us a long time to get to 20, less time to get to another 20, and it's going to take even less time to get to another 40. We're really excited about that. And then lastly, member equity. I don't want to just focus on the amount of revenue and savings that our member partnering farmers have, but it is something to celebrate. Right now, collectively across, 2,157 active groups, there is a combined member equity of $8,843,334. Globally, our members boast a 19% return on savings. So that is an incredible number. I wish I could get 19% return on savings. And another factor that's really promising is that 65% of savings group membership is female, which is another opportunity to empower women to roles of leadership. And it's not listed on here, but we currently are partnering with 869 church partners around the globe. Okay, how's my time? Oh, I'm doing pretty good. Okay, I'd like to close with Ellie's story if I can. She is one of our partnering farmers, and this is what she has to say. This is the house that she was living in. She says, I have a really different life now. Things have really improved. I used to live in a mud house, which is this one, but I've moved from mud to modern. From my business, I also bought two goats. I'm a single mother, four children. One is my own, but three I've adopted to help take care of because their parents died a while ago. That's Ellie's old house. That's Ellie's new house. Ellie is using the old house now to do her laundry. And it is just an exciting, it's such a wonderful representation, physical representation of what is possible through partnership in our program for these partnering farmers. So if you want to learn more, there is one opportunity that you, I believe maybe got passed out by Mona there on the chairs. Our 2021 Planting Hope Gala and conference is coming up. Starting on October 4th, you can join us virtually every day at 3 p.m. for a live Q&A with Plant with Purpose staff and friends. On a host of topics, we're going to talk about how we're empowering women. We're going to talk about what it means to have hope in the face of climate crisis. We're going to do a deep dive into our latest impact report. We just finished up our our triennial study. It's the second of those studies. It's a lot of wonderful information that's coming out of that, and a lot of exciting, encouraging information that really just reinforces that our approach to watershed restoration is having the impact that we had hoped that it had. And then finally, our upcoming country expansion and watershed expansion, which I want to talk about briefly. I know at St. David's, there is a very close connection to Malawi, specifically the Anglican Diocese of Southern Malawi. We are still looking through our opportunity map on where we ultimately are going to be working, but we have selected Malawi as our ninth country that we're going to be working in, which is super exciting to us. And someday when I come back, hopefully I can bring an opportunity map and show you how we actually select it. Because what we do is we take statistics on poverty and overlay them with what we see as heavily deforested areas. And so it's like take pink and blue, and then you lay them over each other over the country outline. You see purple spots light up. And those are the areas where we want to work, because that's the areas where we see the greatest opportunity for growth and change. And so we're super excited about doing that in Malawi starting. Actually, this year, we're kind of laying groundwork, and then we'll begin full program operations, or at least our pilot program in Malawi, sometime next year, after the end of this fiscal year. So if you want to tune in and learn about all those different things, you can, if you go to this www.plantwithpurpose.org/gala, for $1, you get to sign up, and you can attend all of these conferences that happen every day at 3 PM from, October 4th to October 8th. And then I also, would allow you to tune in for a 1-hour special event on Friday night or Saturday night, October 9th. You'll get to hear a message from Scott. We'll premiere our 2021 Global Impact video and have all sorts of other fun stuff for y'all to be able to do. Yes. 3 p.m. Central. Yes. Yes, the 3 p.m. Central, definitely. And my information is down here at the bottom. So you, my email address is will@plantwithpurpose.org. That's my cell phone. You feel free to call, text, email. If you have any questions or just want to talk about environmental restoration or tree planting or savings groups or anything that we've talked about today. Also, I have a sign-up sheet outside, and there's some little brochures that might be helpful in kind of continuing your thoughts on the issue. Please take one of those. And I guess at this point, I will see, hopefully they didn't say they can't hear me. Okay, that's it. They couldn't hear your intro, Mona. So at this point, I'm gonna stop sharing, or I'll just kind of stop talking and say, who has any questions? Because we have about, I don't know how many minutes we've got, but we've got a few, yes. So do we work in Muslim countries? We do work in countries that have Muslim populations, currently predominantly Muslim countries. We're not working in the Middle East. And instead we're working in sub-Saharan Africa, which typically is more Christian. And then obviously Latin America and Mexico, predominantly Christian. And then how do we do the trees? That is a very good question. And you've got me stumped at the moment, but I know at some point we typically will help with some of the seedlings to get the tree nursery started. But at some point they turn around and they are the ones that are purchasing the trees, the saplings and the to then ultimately plant. And then they're learning about grafting and how to start their own nurseries, so that they are constantly harvesting seeds, planting those seeds, creating saplings, and selling them to community members or giving them away to community members. We want it to, again, we want it to be as self-sustaining as possible. We are there to educate and encourage and to come alongside and hopefully participate in their transformation. So, yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. How do we find them? A lot of it is, So what I would say is this, we rely heavily on really strong local leadership. When we think about going into a country, typically we are going to partner with someone who is already working closely in the areas where we want to work. They already have a wonderful lay of the land. and know the communities that are in greatest need. Some of it is exploration. And so we will also go out and do a survey and just kind of go out into the communities, into the watersheds, find the watersheds that we want to work in, and then go and just talk community to community and find out and kind of ask some preliminary questions to get that baseline assessment. So yeah, it's hard, right? It's hard to find them. But thankfully we have really tremendous country directors that are incredibly connected to these vulnerable communities and know how to find them. Next. Any questions from, oh gosh, what is it? Alt tab. Any questions from the chat? I don't see any. All right. Yeah. We do not. Although I will say, right. Yeah, you bring up a really strong point. Yeah, we get asked often, it's like, how can, you know, have you thought about working in the United States? And the answer is yes, but it just seems to be, you know, within our context, within our capacity, it seems like our model, our watershed model, works best in rural, more impoverished communities. Countries that you would consider to be in development or developing, not developed. With that being said, there are farmers around the country who are starting to buy into the idea of sustainable agriculture and are implementing a lot of the same techniques that we teach our partnering farmers, low tillage practices, crop differentiation, having multiple crops on the same plot, interspersing trees with crops, all that stuff. And they're seeing tremendous returns on investment as a result of making that shift. You know, it's always the problem of you're fighting against heavy subsidization for monoculture crop planting. And it's just kind of hard to, everything that we have seen and heard is that, you know, farmers are just hesitant. They're scared to make that shift because it's such an unusual approach. And also they would lose those subsidies that, you know, many of them rely on in order to make ends meet at the end of the year. Let me go back and say briefly is when we go in and work in a community, when we work in a watershed, we are committing to about 7 to 10 years of work in that community. And in that watershed at minimum. Oftentimes it takes us that long to reach the number of communities that we need to reach, to establish the number of purpose groups that we need to establish in order for our practices and our techniques to take hold, take root, and to really because once you reach around 60%, the spillover effect, it just takes off and it does its own thing. And so there's no, you know, we don't need to stay there any longer. We stay in an area for 7 to 9 years with the hope then that, you know, they'll take on the lead and we'll continue to work with them, partner with them, share resources, et cetera, but no longer be in teaching mode. We'll be in co-creator mode. And that allows us to move on into another watershed, typically an adjacent watershed. Because again, we want to start small and go out and out and out. Think back to the Texas watershed map is a good example of that. We started in Austin. We then would either move up the Colorado River, or we might start at the top of the Colorado River and work our way down because we see downstream effects as we improve the source moving towards outflow. So, yeah. Oh, okay. Let's see. Okay, no questions. See why you're excited. Wonderful. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Anything else? Yeah.
Have you ever thought of developing teaching U.S. schools on environmental science?
I'm sure some people in our organization have. But I am not aware of any. And so I would say that no, right now we're not currently focusing on that. We do, however, work with schools on these types of programs, educating youth specifically in Mexico, because it is so impactful on their understanding and their roles. You know, as you work with people younger and younger, you know, they get this sense of identity early on, and it just carries them into adulthood and sets them up for greater success. Yes. Yeah.
One of the things I've been impressed with is this is definitely a work in design. Mm-hmm. And I just very scientific. But one thing I have is I know some think a timeline where you have sort of a mature community, maybe not beginning out when you're leaving, but at some mature point, how many of the people that are in the program are both outsiders versus local?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, so we have 250 staff across 8 countries. We have about 26 staff based out of the U.S. A large part of our monitoring and evaluation staff are based out of the United States. And then we have country directors and staff. Most of our staff average around 26 to 30 in each in a given country. Some countries are smaller, some are a little bit bigger. We have about 25 to 30 staff members per country. You know, they're covering, the ratio is incredibly significant, I guess is what I would say. I'm trying to think of a specific country number that we work in. Like the Dominican, I think we work with about 9,000 individual participants. That translates to roughly 35,000 participants as a family participants. And we have about 28 staff. And so that I think maybe gives you a little bit of scope, if that helps. So we have staff, and then we have local leaders that are from that community, specifically the churches, that are oftentimes not paid. That are just doing this out of their care and concern for the community, they're going to stay when we leave. So that staff of 26 in the Dominican, they're going to be in a country and in a region for 7 to 9 years, or in a watershed for 7 to 9 years before they're moving on to the next one. And that's where, you know, that's really the equivalent of one purpose group or one savings group. And I'm going to quote it wrong, so I'm not going to quote it, but I know we have in excess of 100 savings groups across the Dominican Republic, as an example. And so it's one versus 100 as far as like local leadership versus national paid country staff that we work with. Did that get to the heart of it, kind of, hopefully? Okay.
In a few years, looking back to
I think we will see. We have not done any pandemic specific modeling, and I don't anticipate that being a thing that we do. But we will, I think, see those impacts in our next triennial impact evaluation, which again, we just finished up so we evaluated program years between 2018 and 2020, released our report in 2021. So we'll do another evaluation that covers 2021 to 2023 at the end of 2023 and put that out in 2024. So I think we will see the impacts of the pandemic in that report. And it'll be an interesting, nobody knows what that's going to happen, how that's going to impact. But let me close with this, because I think I have at least a minute. One of the things that we've seen specifically throughout the pandemic, we get quarterly reporting from all of our country staff and all of our communities. One of the things that we have seen is, despite our country staff being stuck in Port-au-Prince, for example, in Haiti, and not being able to get out to the communities, thankfully, thanks to technology and to kind of our locally led model, our participants are continuing to hit the targets that we laid out for them in the year, despite the fact that COVID was such a disruptor. And in fact, you know, you look at somewhere like Haiti, and COVID's probably like fourth down on the list of things that are disrupting it. You know, you have currency devaluation, you have the assassination of the president, you have political instability, you have natural disasters, you also have COVID over here, right? Like it's disaster upon disaster upon disaster. And yet despite that, what we saw is that our Haiti program was able to achieve, hit 100% of target or exceed their target goal in almost every metric across starting new church groups, planting trees, and starting and strengthening savings groups, which I think is just, again, a testament to how essential that local leadership is when our paid staff can't get out there and connect with them, and why I think, you know, our model is the best. But you bet. You bet. I'm so happy to be here. And okay, just checking to make sure there's no more chat. Thank y'all for having me. Thank you.
You can find more lectures and sermons on iTunes by searching for St. David's Episcopal Church in Austin, Texas, or visit our website at saintdave.org and click on the podcast button.